get to a certain speed, the drug chute then comes out. Decelerates by that. Yeah, this thing's got to wind up in like a 10-mile area, by the way, too. You don't have to have a 130-mile footprint like the last one, the last two flights. I think they're supposed to come down like within a 10-mile area. They're really going to really push the envelope. Thank you.
August 5th is what day of the month, Paul? What day of the week?
I haven't looked that one up yet. I have to look at my calendar, which will take me about 2 seconds. But, yeah. Either way, I'm going to have my recorders going. I'll probably watch it live. As long as I'm here, I'll be watching it.
I think you're saying it's going to be 5 o'clock in the morning UTC, which, if that's true, that's around 9 o'clock in the morning our time. Is that true?
It's on a Sunday, Dick.
Okay, beautiful. Sunday. And did you say like 5 in the morning UTC, Paul?
They said early morning UTC, so, you know, I don't know what they mean by that, you know. The time could be adjusted. They make midterm mid-course corrections as they go. They have planned from the beginning 6 mid-course corrections. The first one was canceled because it was right on target, and then they did make one. So there's probably, you know, maybe 3 or 4 more that they're going to do, and that changes the time a little bit one way or the other.
Now, with a nuclear power supply, this thing is not dependent on solar heating, solar photovoltaic energy being received. He's got a continuous power source. He can run year-round, if I understand correctly, hot, cold, whatever. He's also going to have all kinds of testing equipment. I presume the main thing going on here, this is a much more serious look for water and past life, is my guess. In other words, biologicals. Is that the major thrust of this one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, the other ones were more of geologists, you know. You know which one had a stove on board, which, you know, kind of looked for organic? The Phoenix, the one that landed near the North Pole of Mars. That one, you know, that wasn't a rover. That just landed straight down. And that had a scoop on it. Did a lot of good science. Found ice, you know, real ice. Things like that. But now, yeah, this one got a much more sophisticated setup. Yeah, you know, you got a scoop and this drill, and it's going to pulverize it. The drill's wind up in fine powder. They'll be able to put it into this chemical stove and cook it. Use the spectrum analyzers on it to figure out what it is before they cook it. Yeah, really, it's a true lab. I mean, before they called it Curiosity, it was called Mars Science Laboratory, so, which is really a good name for it. It's got 10 different, I think at least 10 different pieces of equipment, testing equipment to do different things, including like lasers that shoot up into the air and be able to do a lot of weird things with it. Plutonium on board the RTG radio. What is it? Let me think. RTG. T is thermocouple. G is generator. R is radiation. Let me drop it.
Could it be radiological thermal generator? Thermionic generator?
I forget the first one. I've said it so many times. It's out of my head. Thermocouple. Thermocouple system. So that's really what it is. A million thermocouples put in parallel and series with the carbon blankets surrounding the generator. And as it gives off the neutrons and all, it heats the blanket. The blanket heats the thermocouples, you know, being the similar metals you have series and parallel the thing, you wind up putting out, I don't know, 1,000 watts of this thing or more. I don't know what it is. Some tremendous amount of power. And you'll be able to ride around on Mars. Mars will be years with this. It's going to be probably like the last two. You know, they were solar driven. They went landed for 3 months, and that was back in January of 04. You know, here we are in 12, and they're still riding. Well, one is still riding around. Spirit shot. Back to you, Dick.
It's radioisotope generated, Dick.
That's it, John. Very good. I forgot.
So radioisotope thermal generator, I think it can run all year round, winter, summer. In other words, it's providing electrical power as well as heating to keep all of the circuits toasty warm with their local heaters. And has anyone estimated the RTG itself? Is it potentially good for a good number of years, maybe a good fraction of a decade? What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, they're good for like, I don't know, forever. Forever might be a long shot, but usually the thermocouples give out first before, you know, the metals themselves, the plutonium will keep going on and on. You know, look at Voyager, you know, back in the late 70s, those two things were launched. They're still working. And they have the RTGs on board. Pioneer had the RTGs. We lost contact with those. But they operated for like, I don't know, 25, 30 years. The Ulysses spacecraft that used to orbit the sun, still does orbit the sun, but it's not working anymore. Actually, they just shut it down for funding. But that thing was, 10 years. Going around the North Pole and the South Pole of the Sun. You've had so many of these things launched successfully. You've got Cassini. That went into orbit, I think, was that 2005 or something like that? 2004 Cassini. Now it's on extended missions. Galileo. That was on extended missions for, 8 years, 10 years, whatever. I don't know. They just go on forever. And it's a proven technology. So I'm in favor of this thing. I think it's going to ride around for years.
The first one that landed on Mars with a good oven inside, I think, was Viking. So Viking was at the late 70s, early 80s. There were two Viking landers, and Carl Sagan was involved with those projects. I think you said we've lost contact with either Pioneer. There were two Pioneers and two Voyagers. Are you sure we've lost contact with both of the Pioneers or both of the Voyagers? Back to you on that one, Paul, K2RIW.
Voyagers are up and running. Pioneers, they lost contact with them. So, I don't know. you've got another one on the way out. New Horizon, that's going to Pluto. There, what I think around 2015 or something. So, and that's going to go beyond the solar system too. That's going to head out to the Kuiper Belt, all little planets beyond Pluto. So, it's really a proven technology. And people used to get upset when they launched it from Cape Canaveral, thinking that plutonium could break apart. Contaminate the world and all, you know, but they've done so many tests, they've tried to break these canisters open and these things are built in, and they've blown them up, crashed them, you know, they can't put a dent in these things. So, good system, many spacecraft have it, and they really need it, but if they need the extra power, the heat is on board and all. In fact, the Viking spacecraft had it too. As you mentioned it. They landed. They didn't have wheels, so wherever they landed, that's what you got. One was on one side of the planet, and the other one was on the other. Back in what, 1970? I guess that was 1977 when they both landed, and they had two orbiters too. Did a lot of science on the drive.
Question for Paul.
Dick, if you want John go?
You're basically out of luck. And those kind of power supplies, unless you can replenish them, they're basically only good for as long as they're, they have enough energy to at least power the basic minimal requirements to break through the system that gives it energy.
I think it was 6LCK or something like that. Alrighty, tell you a little bit about the limitation of the RTG. And when it comes back to you, Paul, or the man from California, I'd like to know who is the manufacturer of that RTG. But John's got a question. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I'll hold until you get the answer to that, Dick.
Okay, the person from California, I think it was, start off with your full call and name and proceed with your information. I think you're coming in to us by Echo Link. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
That's you, John. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah. This is V's Victor Echo 6, Lima Charlie Kilo on Edmonton, Alberta. No, actually, any of those power supplies, they're proven reliable for a certain period of time, but isotope reactors have a degrading power output ratio, and as they degrade, as it gets used up, it actually will, actually burns itself up. It will actually become less and less of a power source. So any of those spacecraft have to learn to live with diminishing power power supply.
I thank you, Gene. Who manufactures that actual device, if you or your buddies out there happen to know? A nice hearing from Vancouver. Edmonton. Wait a minute now. I think it says Edmonton is where you live. All right, go ahead, Gene. Are you still with us, VE6LCK, K2RIW?
These are all very interesting, but they're only good for limited research and limited information. And eventually they're just designed to die like a T-cell in space.
I think that was VE6LCK. What's your best guess as to the longevity of the one that's on Curiosity? And who is the manufacturer of that sub-assembly? VE6LCK, K2RIW.
VE6LCK. I'm not sure who built it, but I do know anything with plutonium, you're good for about 10, 15 years if you reduce the power out, that you take away from the plutonium. But as you use more energy from it, it will react faster, and maybe 5, 10 years, 20 years at the most.
Very fine, Gene. I thank you for that information. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, I might get one of those for a battery for my truck. By the way, I have a question for Paul. Paul, the satellite that's traveling, the spacecraft that's traveling toward the heliopause, which one is it, and has it reached it yet? I know you spoke about it 2 weeks ago. Has there been any updates on that? Over to you, Dick.
Over to you, Paul. I bet it's going to be Voyager. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, you got Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And Voyager 2, I believe, is the one that's closest to it. Voyager 1 made a... You know, it didn't follow the ecliptic. When it got to Saturn, it really wanted to get better, really good pictures of Titan. So they had to change its trajectory a little bit, and it was, by doing that, they got good pictures of Titan, but the thing wound up, of course, going off in a different direction than Voyager 2. Voyager 2 stayed on the ecliptic, so that one's getting closer to the heliopause. The other one kind of went, let's call it north of the solar system. Actually, it was good. It took pictures. It looked back some many years ago and took pictures of all the planets looking down at it, you know. Well, you really can't do that with Voyager 2. I mean, you don't get this mosaic. So, yeah, look at that. I mean, those things were out there in 1977. And here we are all these decades later, and it's still sending data back. I'd be happy if you could get 5 years out of Curiosity. I'd be happy if you get 2 years out of it, but yeah. I mean, if it ever went 20 years, that's really, I'd be pushing it. But anything longer than, I think this one is, like the last one was for 3 months, they would have been happy. This thing is 1 year. So, as far as the heliopause, let me drop it. I haven't read that they've actually hit the, hit it or gone through the heliopause. They got real close. They know they did because the solar, they have these detectors, it's like putting your finger out, and they can detect the solar winds. And when they got down to like zero and started changing direction, which is what started happening, that detected that it was picking up intergalactic solar winds. The sun's influence is starting to drop off, but they're there, but whether they're officially into it or through it, I haven't heard anything. But it might take a year to do it. What is it? Every year they go 3 AU, I think it is, 45,000 miles per hour, hour after hour. That's amazing. Back to you, Dick.
That's really down the road a piece. And that solar wind, those particles being spit out by the sun, on average the sun is spitting out 4 million tons per second of material. They made a rough guess that that's the rate of the solar wind, 4 million tons per second. That's also the rate of mass consumption. 4 million tons per second is the rate at which it's turning mass into energy, solar sunlight by E equals MC squared, and that's how it's producing 3 times 10 to the 26 watts, 3 times 10 to the 26 joules per second. Awful nice bright source. And when you're burning the oil and coal and gas, you're burning past solar events. That's what you're burning. I'd love to see somebody do a calculation of exactly how fast we're using hydrocarbon fuels. If someone told me we're using 1,000 years worth of past solar energy per day by the hydrocarbon fuels we're burning, gas, oil, and coal, I bet you it's in that ballpark, something pretty fast. So we're eventually going to have to go to renewable energy, solar, wind, tide, geothermal, wave, the works, because some of these other fuels are going to get a little bit more expensive and a little bit harder to find someday. I'm not going to get away with this for another century, I don't think. I don't think there's that much more to find. Way back in the oil embargo days of 1973 or so, I guess it was, we thought we were coming to the end of the usable oil. Well, that was just like George Burns used to say, predictions about my obituary are premature. Quite that fast. Okay, fun stuff. One of the questions that Wesley has asked us, if it's that we'd like to discuss, he's got a list of questions in his last email. Microwave waveguide, if you've got a plasma in it, what's it like? How would a circulator in that waveguide behave? What happens if you deform the waveguide? And pseudo switches, can you make a switch out of that and squirm? Now, I personally have experienced a plasma inside of a waveguide. It was a very high-power S-band transmitter that I was using at the salt mine. Let me think now, 1984-85. We were doing a high-power experiment simulating some of the transmitters that are used on the B-1B bomber at AIL. And we were using a very high-power Klystron amplifier, feeding a piece of waveguide that were feeding various components that we were testing, filters and switches and power dividers and antennas and things like this. And periodically, we would strike an arc inside the waveguide. Let me drop. So, periodically, we struck an arc inside the waveguide. inside the waveguide there was an optical detector that once it saw the flash of light that occurs when you arc over a piece of waveguide. The beautiful dark color inside the waveguide becomes very bright. The optical detector sees that, and it fires a protection circuit that turns off the klystron to protect the klystron. One of the things that we were testing was high-power filters. One of the things that we discovered is that when you have a high-power pulse-up traveling wave tube running a zillion watts, I won't say how many, and you arc over the piece of coaxial cable or the filter. I think it was actually a filter. We had a bandpass filter that if there were extraneous parts floating around inside the filter, you could initiate an arc within the filter when the RF energy is present, because the filter was not operating in a vacuum. It was operating at the normal air pressure when you're on the ground, and partial vacuum you're up in the air, depending on how well it's sealed. So you arc over the filter, and that arc would take all of your RF energy, absorb it. The arc is a negative impedance. You feed more power into it, it becomes more conductive. It's a beautiful dummy load, if you know what I mean. So all the RF energy being created by your traveling wave tube is going into that arc and being converted into heat. The heat it makes when it's inside of a coaxial cable has essentially no limit. It will melt anything in the vicinity. So what it's doing is arcing from center conductor to shield, slowly eating itself back through the coaxial cable, and it keeps right on going. If you keep transmitting, you'll keep right on arcing and creating heat and making it plasmarize, vaporizing the metals of your center conductor of your coax cable. That arc will keep right on doing that. Eventually, it eats itself all the way back to the vacuum window on the output connector of the traveling wave.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you didn't have the right kind of...
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty cool system. But I know eventually they're going to have to go to using things like the solar winds and the particles and the gravitational field and magnetic fields generated by the Earth and stuff like that to generate power for in-space, as well as because a lot of those particles and that travel for massive distances and can be used.
Yeah, I think that was Gene from VE6 land, and what he's saying is that there are other methods of harvesting energy that's presented to us on Earth, as well as solar voltaic and wind and tide and gravity. What I'm looking for now, geothermal. So there are other kinds of magnetic fields. It's obvious by the fact that when you get a major solar event that occurred way back in the 1850s, that occurred again, I think, around the year 2000, when you get a major solar event, when you get a whole lot of charged particles hitting the Earth, and that gets picked up by your transmission lines for power, that your major grid going across North America, that grid picks up the charged particles, induces a voltage in them, a DC voltage, and the transformers you have on both ends of that transmission circuit cannot tolerate DC current. You start saturating those cores, and you start burning up those transformers. And so we've had some of those kind of, once per decade you get a blast of energy that's huge, but it's only once per decade, so it's a hard one to harvest. But what I'm getting at, though, is that in the case of striking a plasma arc across the coax cable where you're feeding high-power RF energy, and you can make a plasma arc in a waveguide, you can make a plasma arc in a coax cable. In either case, the air molecules across that gap are becoming conductive because of the arcing energy. That negative impedance, let me drop. That negative impedance of that energy, as long as you're feeding enough RF energy into it, is making huge temperatures, thousands of degrees Kelvin. It will slowly eat its way through the center conductor and work its way back toward the source of the RF energy. And eventually, it'll arc through the vacuum seal on the output end of your traveling wave tube. Your traveling wave tube loses its vacuum, and it stops making RF energy. So if you don't have the right kind of detecting circuit to detect the arc and kill the transmitter accordingly, and then provide some kind of protective action, you can destroy some very expensive hardware in the process. So arcs are pretty destructive if you don't detect them. Detecting them is not easy, because under certain power levels, the arc could come close to presenting a 50-ohm load impedance. And how do you detect a perfect 50-ohm load at the end of a coax cable that's really made by an arc? Optically, you probably could, as long as you've got air in the coax. If it's a foam-filled coax, that's not so easy. You could put thermal sensors in various places, but detecting the arc in a reliable manner, usually done by a reverse directional coupler. John is doing lots of experiments these days on finding out what a directional coupler in the forward and the reverse mode can do to tell you what's going on in your radio transmission circuit. Let me drop it. And there are beautiful coaxial couplers that will sample the forward-going energy and the reverse-going energy in your transmission line. Doesn't matter if your transmission line is coax, waveguide, double ridge waveguide, single ridge waveguide, thin line, twin lead. If you're smart enough, you can build a directional coupler for any kind of transmission line. And if you're smart enough, that allows you to sample in a calibrated manner the amount of energy that's flowing in a forward manner on that transmission line and the amount of energy flowing in the reverse direction on that transmission line. Believe it or not, the forward flowing energy and the reverse flowing energy are two thoroughly independent events, even though both of those events may have come from the exact same signal generator. That transmission line, inside the transmission line, when he's operating correctly, he keeps the forward flowing energy and the reverse flowing energy thoroughly separate. By way of your slotted line and your method of non-directionally sensing the forward and reverse flowing energy, for the first time, you create an interferometer out of them by moving that slotted line probe up and down with its carriage, I mean left and right, if you know what I mean, down the transmission line and up the transmission line. You sense what you call a standing wave ratio. It's an interferometry effect of the forward and reverse going signal. You have created a standing wave in the probe of your slotted line. The standing wave itself, you could say, did not exist on the transmission line. There's a forward-going amount of energy and a reverse-going energy. And with smart directional couplers, you can independently pick up each one of those. So this is getting along the lines of what Wesley is asking us about now, a plasma inside of a transmission line, whether it be a waveguide or a coax cable, and a circulator. Let me drop. A circulator is a kind of component usually built with magnetically biased ferrite material. By way of magnetically biased ferrite material, in the vicinity of a properly designed transmission line-like circuit, you can make it in such a way that energy flowing in the forward direction through the circulator goes through the circulator with maybe a quarter of a dB or a third of a dB of insertion loss. Energy flowing in the reverse direction on that exact same output cable from that circulator goes again in the clockwise manner, and the very next terminal on the circulator is a 50-ohm termination. Therefore, forward-going energy goes to the circulator with no insertion loss. Reverse-going energy comes back to the circulator, ends up in the internal termination or external termination. And if you've done a real good job on that circulator, I have personally used a circulator that, if it's a ordinary one made to mediocre characteristics, will have 18 decibels of directivity. A real good one would have 25 or 30 dB, and a carefully tuned one can have over 40 decibels of directivity. The forward-going signal experiences a couple of tenths of a dB of insertion loss. The reverse-going signal experiences as much as 40 decibels of insertion loss. Therefore, your transmitter, which feeds the circulator, which feeds the antenna, that transmitter will forever be happy seeing nothing but a 50-ohm load, even if you put a dead short circuit on that antenna and you open up the connector to the antenna. The transmitter will never know it. So if you want to protect a transmitter from high standing wave ratio events, let me drop, a circulator can do a beautiful job of that. And at VHF, UHF, and microwave frequencies, making a circulator in the conventional manner by using a magnetic biasing magnet on a piece of ferrite inside of this transmission line-like structure, usually in a Y shape, at those frequencies, VHF and above, circulators are pretty nice. Your next question is going to be, can I build a circulator at 80 meters? And now life gets complicated. I think the answer is almost no with normal use of materials. You're better off using a reverse power detecting circuit on your transmitter, which cuts back the drive or turns off the transmitter when it sees something greater than, let's say, a 1.5 standing wave ratio. Building a circulator at very low frequencies, where some of the internal subcomponents of the circulator are something like a quarter wavelength long, and a quarter wavelength long at 80 meters is 60 some odd feet, you and I are not likely to build a conventional circulator with 60 some odd feet of diameter at 80 meters. Maybe somebody out there can say a couple of words about, is it possible to build a passive circuit circulator at, say, 80 meters? If you could, there are times when it would be very handy. We'll stand by if somebody out there has got an idea on that one. K2LIW listening.
Victor Echo 6, Lima Charlie Kilo. Well, the trouble with the circulator that you're talking about is using air. But if you can change the properties and the light factor of the material, uses the light factor of different materials, and then combine them, you can actually create a circulator that is actually where the material itself isn't affected. You'd have to have very stable material. There's always degenerate matter, but the fact is that the systems you're talking about using plasma, but the systems I was talking about are using the actual lines of force to actually absorb the energy, because it you have a sympathetic line of force and you pick it up as a secondary frequency.
N2XJN.
It sounds like Gene, I think it is, VE6 LCK, has worked with circulators. And I do know that there are very fancy, very high dielectric ceramic materials, say, for instance, barium tetratitanate, which I believe can have a dielectric constant of 100. Take the square root of 100, you get 10. So therefore, a so-called microwave or HF circuit built with a large enough amount of barium tetratitanate could be built in one-tenth the size. So when it comes to the transmission line section, to shrink it down by 10 to 1 with barium tetratitanate, you could do that. I don't know if the ferrite materials can also have dielectric constant of 100 and shrink that down by 10 to 1. But even a 10 to 1 shrink down of an 80-meter circulator, where a quarter wavelength that used to be 62 feet is now 6.2 feet, to take that many cubic feet of these very expensive, let me drop them, to take that many cubic feet of these very expensive materials and build a 6-foot diameter of it just in order to make a passive protection circuit for an 80-meter transmitter, I suspect that that's not practical. I think we're way ahead of the game to build good directional couplers to sense the presence of the reflected energy and then react accordingly to protect that transmitter rather than really at the nanosecond level, so to speak, protect the circuit by a thoroughly passive circuit. That's my first cut on this one. I don't think anybody has built circulators at anything below, let me pick a number, 6 meters. I think very few circulators have been built at any frequency lower than about 50 megahertz is a guess on my part, but maybe Gene has got more experience with that one, and maybe he's done it. Victor Echo 6, Lima Charlie Kilo, K2LAW. Go ahead, Gene. My name is Dick.
Yeah. Well, basically, I wouldn't suggest using huge amounts of these materials. Just a slight skin with a catalyst to stabilize it, and a ceramic material underneath to withstand it. As for some of the other things, remember, it's not just materials that can give you a different light factor. It's just density. For instance, if you create a higher density gas, it will do the same thing.
My understanding, Gene, and correct me on this one, that the whole principle of operation of a circulator is that by way of the ferrite magnetic materials with the magnetic bias, you create gyrotropy. In other words, the velocity of propagation through the ferrite magnetically biased material, the velocity of propagation in the clockwise manner through your circulator, and the velocity of propagation in the counterclockwise manner differ by a certain amount, and if you have the right number of wavelengths between the three terminals, you can make everything work in such a way that the energy you put into terminal number one comes out of terminal number two and gets canceled at terminal number three. Energy you put in terminal number two comes out terminal number three and gets canceled at terminal number one, and so on. So it looks like the signal is flowing only clockwise in my example. In reality, the signal is always flowing clockwise and counterclockwise simultaneously, but in one direction it goes faster than the other direction. Therefore, at the appropriate port, it adds in a constructive manner. At the inappropriate port, it adds in a destructive manner, and therefore you and I get what we call circulation. But in order to get enough differential velocity, clockwise versus counterclockwise, I don't think you can do that with a simple coating of the gyrotropic material. I think you have to have a reasonable amount of volume of the magnetically biased gyrotropic material, usually ferrites. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one, Gene. VE6LCK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, my thinking is that it's only used in certain sections. And it has to be thicker than others, but it would have to be directional and magnetically guided, of course. But I think that it would have to literally supply its own magnetic field. Remember, there's going to be a lot of waste energy that can be put back into the magnetic field and push it forward. So, for instance, a pulse from a couple seconds ago gets put back into energy a couple pulses later at a time that is triggered by the actual pulse coming in a couple pulses later.
The actual gyrotropic effect by which you get two different velocities of propagation, one velocity of propagation clockwise and another direction, velocity of propagation counterclockwise around the ring of the circulator magnetic structure, the coaxial, the transmission line-like structure, the method by which you get these two different velocities of propagation is the fact that the biasing magnetic field is creating precession of those electrons that are moving around those magnetic particles. And you adjust the amount of magnetic field so that the rate of precession is essentially identical to your operating frequency. To make that all come out right, I don't think you can do that with a simple coating of the gyrotropic material. I think it takes a substantial amount of the gyrotropic material where essentially all of the RF energy in your transmission line-like circuit is lighting up, so to speak, all of your ferrite material. So I don't think a simple coating can do it. And you're adjusting this magnetic field for this precession rate, which I guess you could call a molecular resonance is one way of looking at it. I wonder if you agree or disagree with that. I'm not a real pro on this one, Gene. I've worked with circulators. I've tuned up circulators. I've moved them in frequency. I've adjusted their isolation characteristics. But what's really happening at the molecular level is a little bit mysterious to me. A Yig filter and the resonance of the precession you get there and the Yig-like material in a circulator and the kind of resonance you get there with the external magnetic field, I think has some similarity, but I could be wrong. VE6LCK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, a circulator is basically like a coil, except for one little thing, in that it concentrates the energy in a form that appears to be measurable. But a magnetic field basically is only the one line. But if you take the magnetic lines of multiple coils close with each other, effects on. For instance, you got a strong enough magnetic field, you can generate plasma without the electrical field just by putting in the right frequency to the material, igniting it magnetically. But the trouble with plasma is it's not really controllable. But the particles themselves are particles that can be charged. So therefore, not only can you use the electromagnetic effect to produce a higher voltage but lower current, you could actually increase the energy level of the particles, run them in a circulator, and then you would get a good amount of energy out of it at a lot less cost.
If I took you literally, Gene, it would sound like we're getting above unity power transfer of some kind here, and I think that's not what you're saying. First of all, what I think you did say, which is rather interesting, is that if I had got a strong enough magnetic field and a fast enough rate of change of the magnetic field, I can also initiate a plasma by way of Lenz's law or Faraday's rules. I'm converting rate of change of magnetic field into the equivalent of an E field locally generated. That's sort of what an antenna does. And I can arc over the air again by just having a very strong magnetic field with a fast enough change of rate. But you're now making it sound like I can boost magnetic energy, that I can exceed unity. In other words, I can get more magnetic energy out of a circuit than what goes in. And I'm a little bit confused by that one. It sounded like that's what you're saying. Maybe that's not what you're saying. But in a parallel question, what is the lowest frequency circulator really used in a transmitter that you have ever heard of, Gene? Have you ever heard of a circulator being used at a frequency lower than, say, 50 megacycles? VE6LCK, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, it's entirely possible. Only a circulator is the cavity that allows the particles to rotate faster and faster. But what I'm talking about is actually taking a frequency that mixes with a resonant frequency, let's say, of the Earth or of some particles in a storm. So instead of fighting the particles in the storm, you mix it and then you mix another signal into it or another receiver that can actually take that energy and kick it back and transmit it out. You're not getting any more energy than you're getting more energy put out, but it's not free. But what you're doing is you're taking it away from the energy that's, let's say, in the excited particles that are passing near the Earth.
When you're talking about a plasma in space and putting energy in and out, maybe you're talking about something a little bit similar to the HAARP experiment, H-A-A-R-P, I think it is. This artificial ionospheric generator. Are you suggesting that has the possibility of weather modification? Could I modulate the strength of a hurricane by doing something like that? Or are you also talking about particles entering the Earth and you're talking about harvesting energy that Mother Nature has provided? When it comes to something like solar wind, which is such a rare event, I mean a major solar storm, it's such a rare event that to build expensive hardware covering many thousands of square miles in order to harvest that energy strikes me as an expensive way to go that gives you a lot of energy, but only once per decade. I know I've got two or three different subjects in there. Approach any one of them you want to, Gene. Make sure you don't talk too loud because occasionally your voice jumps out of your local Echo Link repeater. VE6LCK, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, the thing that you're talking about is basically, it's no different from mixing two radio signals. Let's say I take a very weak signal from a mixed signal, I put it into a cable, okay, and then it mixes with a very strong signal, okay? Now it's regulated, but now you have this excess energy that pulls off to the side without taking out the actual receiver. But this other energy is actually usable and can be put in and remodulated. Remember that phasing doesn't have to happen in a circulator. That's a technology that's very interesting, but it has to be done in a way like a ramjet without moving parts and without particles that's very stable material that only, like a catalyst, only support the actual reaction, but do not take part in it. And the cables and boxes you're talking about all take part in the reaction.
You did talk about mixing signals on a cable, which I think I'm going to call it a transmission line. If I put more than one simultaneous frequency into a transmission line, those signals, in general, do not react with each other, unless something connected to that transmission line represents a nonlinearity of voltage versus current, voltage versus impedance. There's got to be some kind of a nonlinearity, like a mixing diode. So without a nonlinear something, plasma is nonlinear, negative impedance, but without something like diode or nonlinear material, putting more than one frequency on a transmission line does not in itself create interaction of those frequencies or mixing of those frequencies. So in the multiple frequencies you want to put into a transmission line, what was the nonlinear element that was creating the mixing or other kind of interacting, Gene? VE6LCK, K2LIW.
Bayesian chambers. They would go in and be tuned to push out. So they would be tuned to put out a signal that would basically be similar, and then they would be phased in such a way that they would support each other. You would have to exactly mix, but you could use Bayesian chambers to actually have the same. They start to peak and they go down at the same time. They wouldn't mix, but the fact is you would collect the total energy from them in terms of a diode or something taking it out of the energy. Like you could use like a passive diode system, an arcing system, any kind of a system like that. But there are ways of getting it out without just a little geranium or a silicon diode, because diodes are only a small effect. People have been doing it for years with tubes.
Yeah, when it comes to very large amounts of energy, you're going to have to use a vacuum tube. You take, for instance, the very long-range megawatt, megavolt, half megavolt DC transmission systems that are used by the power station. I guess it's in Ontario or in Quebec. Quebec Power, I guess it is, Power and Light. And a good buddy of mine, Barry Malawanchuk. I can't think of Barry's call letters right now. I presume it's VE2. It'll come to me later. He worked at that power station, and in order for them to take the AC power coming out of a three-phase alternator, call it generator, running by hydroelectric, and convert that to DC, and then transmit it on the transmission lines, there's a lot of advantages of sending DC. You get a lot more efficiency, and you get a lot less interaction effects with solar events. Let me drop. But somewhere at the far end, you've got to convert the DC back into 60 hertz AC. And I think they're doing that with these huge vacuum tube-like thyrotrons, which I think each one of them is about the size of a 40-gallon oil drum. And so there is a real big high-power plasma-like vacuum tubes doing the rectifying and the circuit waveform generation in order to convert the DC back into AC. Converting the DC back into a pure sine wave of AC, that's an art and science all by itself.
Sure, that there's nothing for the shockwave to destroy, just something to collect the energy. That's what happens. Energy is wavelengths of energy, whether it's microwave or radio wave, it's all the same. It's just a matter of frequency. So if you were to ever to take any kind of energy source and try to apply physics that is totally special to it, not really. Atomic energy still has to follow certain rules. And but what I'm talking about is basically taking energy, phasing it into a form that can be phased into peaks that are simultaneous at the same time coming out of a generator, and then absorbing that energy as a broadband receiver would give you a huge amount of energy.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble understanding the subject matter that you're speaking about right now, Gene. Are you talking about building, let's say, a hydroelectric power generating system? that's set by these various frequency and cavity and resonating techniques that you're describing, are you suggesting that there's a way of making a hydroelectric power generator running at, say, 60 hertz, making it more efficient than it currently is? And if you're not talking about that kind of a generator, what kind of a generator are you discussing right now, Gene? VE6LCK, K2RIW?
Two ways of doing it. You got to find an energy stream. So if you get an energy stream out of a turbine, that's what you use, right? Phase is everything. Now, if you can get the energy phase into it, for instance, you take a laser. Why does a laser work? Those light waves do not blend or become part of it. They just appear to. What they do is they're phased in such a way that they all peak at the same time, coming out at the same point. That's what it is, the laser is. But those light waves have never mixed. They just come out at the same time. Now, it's the same with electricity and all those other things. Now, any electricity, for instance, in a power system that bounces back, instead of shorting it out, what you do is you put it into another power source and you make a return system to put it back into that other power source in the future so that it doesn't affect the power source that originally started. So you're using more efficient power. For instance, the solar panel can receive a lot more light if you turn it into a light receiver and turn it into a light receiver instead of a solar panel that's 0.7 volts. You have this thing as a light receiver, and it keeps on putting microvoltages into something that collects it and pumps it out when it gets to high enough power.
Okay, let me repeat the question now. Are you saying that by these techniques of taking various phases out of, say, for instance, a hydropower generator, we got a great big dam, we got water flowing through a turbine that's turning a mechanical machine, and in some cases it's a high voltage three-phase alternator or generator. I think it's an alternator. Are you saying that you can make that system more efficient? I'm having a little bit of a problem with that because with proper design, that generator is a micro-ohm of source impedance feeding something that's much higher in impedance, which is the transmission system that goes to the individual power customers. And when it comes to reflected energy on that line, the reflected energy comes back to what it thinks is a nearly short circuit at the original turbine, the power generator, and it does not get absorbed there. You readjust the field in order to generate the right voltage under those operating conditions for that slightly reflective load, but I don't think there's any dissipation there because you make your source of energy nearly 0 ohms and you adjust everything such that the customer's load is a much higher number of significant ohms and he ultimately does all the absorption. I think there's very little loss in that system, but maybe I'm misunderstanding it. VE6LCK, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could... It's a loss because it's not power you expect because it's bounced back and you don't get it, right? Because it's not there anymore. It went through the system. It's already written off. But if you take that bounce back power, run it through another route, and then return it back into the system, that's more like getting closer to 100%. Remember, any power plant today, most power plants today, do not run at 80 or 90% efficiency. Make no mistake. They're lucky to run at 50% if they're lucky at all, and they're usually around 17 to 20%.
If you're talking about the efficiency of the Carnot cycle, that which converts the heat of the coal, gas, or oil through its turbine into a mechanical energy and therefore electromechanical energy, and those inefficiencies you just stated, I agree. But if we talk about the alternator itself, in the case of a hydro plant, the alternator itself receives a certain amount of mechanical energy from its turbine. I believe a well-designed a turbine generator, running on hydro generator, I believe it's running in the high 90 some odd percent efficiency. It is a Thevenin source impedance of nano ohms. That power eventually goes out through the grid to your customers. Whatever energy gets reflected back from the customers does not get dissipated at that turbine generator because it is almost a short circuit. It gets re-reflected forward, adds in a vector manner to the power now being generated, and by you and I adjusting the field at that generator, we adjust the final voltage that it generates, but I think reflected energy does not get dissipated. I think it gets re-reflected forward because that reflected energy back to that alternator slash generator, it thinks it sees a short circuit. VE6 CT LCK K2RIW in the deck net.
Well, any kind of a system where you have a coil is going to do that. Like the systems I was talking about were power receivers. Anytime you turn something into a power receiver, anything that comes back forward or otherwise sideways can be put back into the system by combining another coil into it. Eventually, you just could sort of combine certain kinds of reflections back into it, or sources. For instance, a human body could produce 100 watts of power. And a bigger person more than that. But the thing about it is, it's all scattered energy. But make no mistakes, it's still 100 watts. Whether it's a power plant, for instance, I gotta tell you honestly, I've never heard of a power plant going 90% efficient, honestly, ever. Power losses at combustion level are lost because it's not a molecular level, so you have to, you lose the molecular energy. And then what makes it even worse is, once it hits the turbines, even if they are efficient, at best all they get is maybe 30%, and that's if you're really tuned, 50% if you're really, really tuned. But there was a system, though, where they used moving gases, charged gases, and they moved the gases instead and charged one side and then picked up the energy on the other side. As it turns out, they actually pick up more energy from the magnetic fields around it, and then they release it, so not necessarily from the source that you put into it. They actually can be around 80-90% efficient, but it requires a changing of state from gas to liquid and liquid to gas.
The Carnot cycle, the heat engine that converts the expanding, usually burning material into mechanical energy. Without a doubt, it has some pretty poor efficiencies. However, of the real mechanical energy that arrives at the shaft of the alternator, let's talk about the mechanical energy that arrives at the shaft of a hydroelectric dam. The turbine of the dam itself has an inefficiency problem, but of the real energy that gets to the shaft that is converting rotational mechanical energy into electrical energy. Let me call that the alternator. I believe a well-designed alternator can have efficiencies in the high number of 90% of the alternator itself, not counting the other components of the system, just the alternator. I think the alternator can run at near, let me pick a number, 95%. Obvious by how cool it runs when it's producing 100 megawatts. It's not producing a megawatt of heat, otherwise the building would glow, if you know what I mean. VE6, LCK, K2RIW in the tech net.
Kilowatt, L2XG.
Sir, sure, and you have an SWR, the signal's going to come back at you, right? If your transistor is not heat up, does it not come under the force of the actual transmission? Does it not cause problems? Anything coming back that is not, you can't control the phase and it keeps on coming back, is going to cause your signal to be canceled out or amplified randomly, or according to some math, weird math. But in the end, you have an option that you have to get rid of that, you have to short that out to ground and then generate heat out of it and not get any electrical value. And, you know, you could generate heat more steam to power a turbine, but in the end, anything coming back into the power plant to the generator has to be shunted off You know, I know, because I got books on this stuff, and they always put a diode that shorts out, that shows up as a zero ohm, because it shorts out the back spike.
Let me go one step at a time here, because you and I are having a little bit of a difference of understanding or approach. If I just talked about the electron